sure you are in fellowship and continue on here as we are about to wrap up the actual event that surrounds here, the casting out of multiple demons from this demon-possessed guy, again, who has exhibited every classic symptom of demon possession, the restlessness, the torment, the mental anguish, the self-destructive tendencies, the superhuman strength, the superhuman knowledge. Pretty much everything you would expect out of demon possession is seen in this guy. And rightly so, because, of course, he is possessed, as we know, by probably thousands of demons. Which, again, to me, just screams to the fact that Satan is not short on manpower when he needs it. If he can devote this many demons to one guy, it wouldn't seem as though, and I would assume, of course, that these are lower-level demons. You know, we recognize there is a hierarchy within the demons, but these are probably lower-level demons who don't necessarily have a lot of power and authority, but they're still, I mean, as angelic creatures, they're formidable. And so, having looked at the exegesis of these verses in the first session, we will continue on here. We're ready to deal with verses 15 through 17. They came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed. The they, again, is all the people from the town and the surrounding rural areas that may have had a stake in this. Well, again, we're not ever really fully told. But a bunch of them came out, and it almost does suggest that they did have some kind of stake in this. And so they see him and observe him carefully, by the way, not just observe him, but look at him in great detail. They want to first find out if, for sure, this is the same guy who had been demon-possessed, sitting down, clothed, and in his right mind. Again, these three participles are designed to contrast with his previous behavior and conduct. And the way he dressed, the way he conducted himself, and all that. This is completely the opposite. I mean, 180, so obvious that nobody can miss this. The very man who had had the legion, and they became frightened. Those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man, and all about the swine. And they began to implore him, Jesus, to leave their region, or to leave those districts, those regions, that it's a plural, just to point that out. One, this incident had taken place in the very early evening, as it was getting dark, which only added to the unsettling nature of what had transpired. Again, how close we are to evening and dark, it's tough to say, but we know the day is waning, certainly, by this time. Two, the men in charge of the herd of swine, we are not told how many there were, immediately departed the scene. Most likely they were intent on reporting to the owners of the swine what had happened. Three, nevertheless, in spite of the fact that the city was not too far away, only about a half a mile according to McGarvey in his work, The Fourfold Gospel, he said there were the city, the remains of the city, that there was a small extant city there now, but that it wasn't that far inland. So that's not going to take these guys, and let's assume they're, you know, probably double-timing it back to the city. They're not going to be, you know, meandering. It's not going to take them long, probably, 5-10 minutes max to get back? So, again, how far they traveled out, well, we don't know the variables. And again, there's a number of variables in these stories that you have to just kind of accept and say, well, okay, we don't know that, but it's not really germane. We don't know how far around they had to travel in that region to notify everybody. I mean, if they notified everybody within an hour, then everybody knew that night. And you would even shorten this down to not even extending into the next day. But if they had to travel 2 or 3 hours around, people, by then it's getting late in the evening, people are probably not going to come out until the next morning. But again, just to say that this whole incident took less than 18 hours, the whole thing, from start to finish. And may have been, and certainly was less than that, but couldn't have been much more than that, because one of the things we're going to find out is apparently the very next day, they get right back in that boat and go right back over to Capernaum again. which, again, we wouldn't think would take too terribly long. So Jesus is not gone from the region of Capernaum even a whole day. And that is kind of comes out in the what little bit of chronological notes we have in here. Their determination to publish this event in the surrounding area must have extended into the next day. I presume it did. I'm kind of concluded that they wouldn't be able to notify everybody in a 4 or 5 mile radius, immediately. So I'm just presuming it took until in the morning, but it may not have. They may have gotten to everybody that evening. By the surrounding countryside, it may have been, let's say this was a group operation with only 10 owners. And so they went to, even though they didn't all live in town, they only went to 10 places. Again, we're not told, so there is some variables within here. Although there is no indication in any of the synoptic records, Jesus Christ and those with him must have spent a night along the beach where all this took place. That's the chronology I've put to it, at any rate, at this point. Is that they probably came out early the next day to find out about all of this. And although not mentioned, Jesus and his disciples and all them spent the night there on the beach. Which would also fit with the time of year we think it is, late summer, early fall. The temperatures are not extreme at that time, extremely hot or extremely cold. And so that all kind of fits. And then late summer, early fall also would be the timing that some of these storms would come up. I mean, they were known for that. So 5, the extent to which they published this event may again suggest that the herd was a group enterprise, with many in the city and surrounding areas being involved in the ownership of the pigs. 6, the subjects of the verb came would then be those that resided in the city and those that resided in the surrounding countryside. Matthew indicates that the whole city came out to see what had happened for themselves. That's in the parallel in Matthew 8:34. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus. Pardon me. And when they saw him, they implored him to leave their region. And that is a consistent thing that we have here in all the accounts, is that that when they deal with this, and Luke doesn't actually deal with it. Oh, well, yeah, he does too. They all conclude the same thing. Luke 8:37, all the people of the country of the Gerasenes and the surrounding district asked him to leave them, for they were gripped with great fear. And he got into a boat and returned. So they're all consistent on that point. 7, there seems to be little doubt that the men had identified the man that was responsible. So the assembled group comes to Jesus. It appears that there's not much, it's not hard for them to figure out who actually is in charge of all this. And it's Jesus. He's the one in charge. So 8, the important thing to note in their response is that they observed the man, which uses the Greek verb theoreo rather than the simple verb blepo, to see. And 9, the force of this is that they did not simply see the man, with whom they were all quite familiar. They observed him with a sufficient attention to the details that they could form mental conclusions as they inspected the situation. And so they're, drawing conclusions from this. Okay, what's this mean? It isn't just that we can see him sitting here. What does all this mean? What are the implications of this? Is this man not mentally ill, but had been possessed by demons, and now appears to be not possessed by demons? And if so, then who's responsible for the exorcism? And, of course, they concluded, and rightly so, that it was Jesus. So 10, although the tense of the participle daimonizomai, that means to be demonized, is technically incorrect since it is a present participle, it should be recognized that the people would have likely referred to him by this title, assuming they knew he was demonized. And again, what I would say, too, is in verse 15, the tense of that participle more reflects what the people thought at that current second. And, of course, they were still expecting him to be demonized. 11, from their perspective, he was the demon-possessed man, although such was actually no longer the case. 12, now Mark uses a series of participles to describe the attendant circumstances of the man, that had been demon-possessed. And 13, the first thing that was evident to them was that this previously unrestrained lunatic was now sitting at the feet of Jesus in a tame and submissive manner. That stands out. Obviously, he's been running around. We know that he's very restless. We see that in the that comes across in all the accounts, that he's very restless, that he roams about in the mountains and in the tombs. And Luke 8:35, the people went out to see what had happened. And they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone out, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And they became frightened. So what are they afraid of? Well, there's clearly been an awesome display of power here. That there are powers at work. And not only at work, but at conflict with one another. That these people can figure out. And so they're scared. Well, 14, the second thing these people observed was that the man who previously ran naked through the mountains was now clothed. No doubt one of those accompanying Jesus provided the clothing for the man. And again, we don't know how many people with him, but let's say there were 20, 30, 40. Well, we know he had his disciples with him, so we know there were 13 counting Jesus. But there were other boats, so we're not told specifically how many of the other disciples, pardon me, made the trip, but it seems evident that somebody had provisions and provided for this guy. 15, the third, a participle indicates that the overt physical changes they could see were evidence of the fact that he was in his right mind. Did they stop and talk to him and interview him? Did he speak much during all of this? Well, we're not really told. I mean, none of the authors really addresses that. But whatever was or whatever happened, as they observed this, they could see, well, this guy's not crazy anymore. And you can observe people well enough. I mean, at times you can see, okay, well, their demeanor presents a certain thing. Whether it's hostility, in his case, weirdness and demon possession, or whatever else. And then you can be with people and you can see, well, you know, they don't seem to have that same sort of mental function going on. And so I think it's pretty evident when you deal with people that if somebody's been acting crazy for a long time, it does kind of stand out when they're not acting crazy anymore. I mean, you would notice that. 16, the Greek verb sophroneo is used of good mental health, demonstrating the ability to think in a sound or sane manner with an emphasis on the ability to control oneself. That's a part of being in your right mind, obviously. Self-control is a measure of this. It's not the only measure, but it is a measure. Of the ability to control yourself and not freak out and, you know, fly off the handle and do all these things. You know, that's the thing. And this really stands out because this guy has exhibited none of this ever, as far as they know. I mean, we don't know how long he was out there, but presumably he was a local from that region who had just gone real, real bad. In fact, about as bad as you could go. And so now here he is. Demonstrated no ability to control himself or even want to. And now here he is just sitting there perfectly at ease. And this had to really, again, there has to be almost a surreal quality to this to the people as they go out to kind of try to deal with this, of what's happened here. So 17, this empirical evidence, which was quite compelling to those that saw it, is certainly confirmation of the story that the herdsman had reported to the people. 18, therefore, when they observed this man who had been previously running naked, unrestrained, self-destructive, and violent toward anyone coming near him, sitting in a docile fashion and acting in a sane manner, it had a tremendous impact on those that witnessed it. Again, sometimes the greatest tributes, obviously, to the grace of God are those that need it the most. And Jesus taught a similar principle, or that same principle, as he, you know, gave a parable on a certain occasion. And he asked one, I believe it was Simon in this case, which one would be loved the most? And he said, well, the one that's forgiven the most. And there's a principle that sometimes the hardest cases, the hardest nuts to crack, are the most difficult things. When God cracks them, I mean, it is so evident, the transformation is so evident, that people just don't know what to do with it. Such was with the Apostle Paul, for instance. I mean, he was breathing violence and murder and mayhem at every turn, Saul of Tarsus, towards all the believers in and around Jerusalem, and he wasn't content just to get them and drag them off to prison, both women and children. He didn't care. Paul was hardcore about his religious beliefs, and he believed these Christians were deceivers and leading people astray, and so he's poured his life out, literally, to do them in any way he could, to strike at them at every chance. So much so that he got letters, authority to go to Damascus. He can pursue them from other cities all over the place. And yet, when God cracks Paul, it is such a turnaround that people can't believe it. I mean, and because if you remember there in Acts, I think it's chapter 9 or so, where Paul gets converted, and then this guy is told to go see Saul of Tarsus, and the guy goes, "Are you nuts?" Essentially, it's what he tells the Lord. "Are you nuts? Do you not know who this guy is? I mean, for God, you're pretty ignorant." I mean, that was kind of his take on it, and as you might expect. And so when God really turns a person around who's a real case, it stands out. I remember that. That was one of the things I couldn't argue with. I mean, I was kind of a religious person, even though I was an unbeliever. I was semi-religious. I had believed in God. I would try to read the Bible sometimes, and to no real benefit, of course, because the unbeliever really can't penetrate the mysteries of the Scriptures. We know that from 1 Corinthians 2. And I try to read it, and I could hold my own in most arguments, philosophical and otherwise, religious, even though I wasn't a believer. But what really did get through to me was I had this guy, and then for all intents and purposes, I mean, we were like brothers. We'd been running around together for quite some time. We knew each other well. We were great friends. And he got saved. He converted. And while I could argue with a bunch of other stuff, I could not argue with the obvious change in this guy's life. We were dealing drugs and doing all kinds. I mean, we were just horrible people, trust me. If you think I'm bad now, you're just lucky you didn't know me. Because you would have probably thought, ugh. You may think, ugh, now, but I don't care. I am better. So I saw this guy, though, and he was obviously better. I mean, he suddenly stopped doing drugs. He stopped dealing. He was no fun anymore. He stayed at home with his wife, who he'd been cheating on all the time. I mean, we didn't have a lot of scruples. Let's just put it that way. And all of a sudden, now he's doing all this stuff. He cuts his hair. He's going to church. And I'm thinking, what the hell? And I could argue with a lot of stuff, but I couldn't argue with the visible change I saw in this guy. And that had as much to do with my conversion as probably anything else. And he had actually a lot to do with it. And unfortunately, he's not positive to doctrine, so, but he was there and fulfilled his plan at that time, I guess, as best a person can. I mean, the fundies can get the gospel right. It's not that hard. Believe in Jesus Christ and you will be saved. They'll muddy it up, of course, but with a bunch of other things maybe, but this guy didn't. He was just new enough, just saved enough, and just zealous enough to want his friends to be saved. And so I couldn't really argue with that. Well, these people can't argue with what they see either. And they're looking at this and they're inspecting it closely. Well, 19, Mark adds a parenthetical explanation about this man, since he did not want there to be any doubt as to the identity of the man in view. And that's in the end of verse 15, as the New American Standard translated, the very man who had the legion. This exact same guy. I don't want you guys confused that it's anybody else. It's the exact same guy. So 20, in this case, he uses the appropriate form of the participle to denote that this was the same man that had the legion. The very man that had the legion. The one having had, you got a perfect active participle, the legion. He'd had it in past time, but in this case now there are no existing results. He doesn't have the legion anymore, which is a little bit of a deviation from the use of the perfect, but still it communicates that he'd had it. So 21, the reaction of the people was the opposite of what one might expect. rather than see Jesus as one that offered a great deliverance to one that seemed beyond hope. The people saw him as a threat to them. In 22, one can understand that an event of this magnitude would evoke some awe and possibly fear. However, we are not given the precise reason as to why the crowd acts as it does. In 23, in light of the fact that nothing is ever said about the loss of the herd, it does seem likely that those involved in the enterprise would seek to salvage what they could. My suspicion is no pigs were lost in the filming of this episode. You have that little caveat there at the beginning of it, like they have on the cooking shows. No animals were harmed. Oh, yes, they were. pork fat is a good thing, right? So, again, I would suggest that they didn't really lose anything here. Or they would, I got to believe they would have made an issue out of it. I know people. I know human nature. And if you strike at their pocketbook, that's one of the quickest ways to get them going. And in fact, almost most people will respond to that. You know, hey, you've affected my livelihood here. So it appears to me that for all the arguments about Jesus and maligning him and all that for this, that nobody really suffered anything here in terms of loss. The ones that suffered were the demons. I mean, the pigs are dead, but they were going to be slaughtered anyway. Come on. You're not, again, they're not raising them for pets. So I don't think anybody necessarily lost anything in this deal. 24, further, nothing is mentioned about the very obvious benefit to the man in view, or the benefit to those that have been terrorized by the demoniac. So 25, what we are told is that the people did not respond to this event with anything but fear, suggesting that this great miracle only produced extreme fright in those assembled. Well, okay, let's assume they know the guy's demon-possessed. Let's assume they have some knowledge of the angelic conflict. We don't really know specifically what all these people knew. But one thing is evident. I think they would have figured out that the guy had supernatural strength. And it doesn't seem odd to me to think that they would have figured out that this guy was demon-possessed. And that now he's not demon-possessed. So now this power has invaded the forces of darkness and triumphed over them. And while that might seem comforting to us, to them it just provoked fear. They were just scared by it. But of course, people who are not used to being in the presence of the power of God would react that way, one would expect. We're going to see this fear response a lot. We saw it with the disciples just when Jesus calmed the sea in the previous episode, there at the end of chapter 4. First, he challenges them, why are you cowards, in verse 40? Do you still have no faith? And they became very much afraid and said to one another, again, never addressed Jesus, are you God? You could have asked him. But nobody ever asked Jesus. I mean, that's one of the things that's kind of stunning when you study the life of Christ. I mean, here you have God in the flesh on the planet, and nobody ever asked him hardly anything. Because people all think they're so smart. And we'll see as they approach all this, because we're, strangely enough, even in Mark, I mean, you'd think, well, okay, we're only in chapter 5, we're only a third of the way through the book. Yeah, but we're almost two-thirds of the way through Jesus' ministry. So things are going to be headed towards Jerusalem here, as we're going to tell you, pretty quick. And as that draws closer, the more you begin to see how the disciples are maladjusted to all that. And that Mark does not paint, quote, a real favorable picture of them in this book. But it's an honest picture. They were honestly ignorant and arrogant and all those other things and had all these preconceived notions that they really hadn't chucked yet. But given enough time, and Jesus is only going to have 3.5 years or so with them, not even that full time, because we know that first couple of months, you know, he spent 40 days in the wilderness with Satan, then returned back to John the Baptist, then makes a trip back to Galilee, apparently, and all that, and before he actually calls anybody to follow him, several months pass, apparently. I mean, they may follow him of their own free will, and they appear to in John. So we're headed, and you know, again, even though it would seem, you might think we're early in the book, just bear in mind that we're about two-thirds of the way through the ministry of Jesus already. And so these disciples are afraid, and they don't put all this together until after the resurrection. Then they finally put it all together. Okay, now we see it. And that was another whole thing, again, when we talk about the nature of transformation, that they recognized that these disciples, these unlearned fishermen, had this transformation. I mean, literally, one week they're hiding, cowering in their upper room for fear that the Romans are going to bust in and kill them. Then 2 weeks later, or it was a little longer than that because Pentecost is about 50 days after the Passover. Here they are, boldly now taking on the entire religious establishment of Israel, suffering beatings, imprisonment, and you can't get them to shut up. Well, that's a transformation that was evident to these people. And it stands out. Why? Well, now they see everything from a different perspective. Wait a minute, this was the God-man. He just conquered death. We have no fear. God's plan is unfolding, and we're in the middle of it, and we're pretty well golden. Well, that was true. And so that provoked a great transformation in them. So they go from being these fearful, kind of maladjusted, cowardly guys to these bold articulators of the faith that are just can't be stopped. Dynamos almost. So again, these people respond in fear, as you might expect, but it just produced fright in them. That's it. 26, the Greek word phobeo denoted a profound state of apprehension, fright, fear, or terror, and should likely be given an ingressive force, which they did in the New American Standard. They began to fear. They became frightened. 27, there is little doubt that this was beyond their comprehension. Of course, how many times does anybody see this? I mean, outside of this incident recorded in the scripture, we wouldn't know anything about it. But again, as a part of inspiration and the preservation of the canon, God has provided for us the very same knowledge the first century believers had. Only they could get it from eyewitness accounts. Well, we're getting it from as close to an eyewitness account as you can get. This is probably Peter's recollection of this. And Peter was certainly there. Matthew was certainly an eyewitness to it. We have here a record, an accurate record, of what went on. Rather than seek its meaning, however, they reacted with the typical human response to the unknown. The unknown scares us. There's a certain level, I mean, we talk about control freaks. Everybody is a control freak. Life has to have order and structure. And what none of us want is for these unknown things to come upon us that we're really not prepared to handle. So the unknown has a certain fear about it. That's why there's a fear when you get up to the point of physical death, because you've never known anything but life in this world. And the unknown is frightening at some level. And so here, this is how they respond to it, just as I think we might expect in some ways. Although, given the nature of the great miracle and the peace that was brought to the region, there was also the possibility they could have said, hey, thank you. But they never get that far, as we're going to see. So 28, verse 16 records the fact that when these people came out from the area, they were treated to a retelling of the events that surrounded this incident. 29, the unidentified they should not likely be limited to the herdsmen, since there were also a number of disciples with Jesus Christ that were eyewitnesses to the event. And in fact, it may not include the herdsmen at all. Again, I'm assuming that the herdsmen have given them every bit of information they have. They recognize, you know, again, everything they know probably has been told. So I'm thinking the they here really focuses on the disciples and those who were with Jesus close up and literally observed this from a front row seat. And that is the place, you know, that you want to be, pretty much. If you're going to have to deal with an event and recount it, you really, you know, a front row view is pretty good. And they had it. So 31, the verb Mark uses is diegeomai, which means to provide a detailed account of something, to describe it in full. And 32, their story emphasized the demon-possessed man, with the pigs only seeming to be an afterthought. Which would certainly not have had, which would not have been the emphasis of the herdsmen. I think their emphasis would have been on the herd, on the what happened. So 33, while one might expect people to have reacted somewhat differently, the text is plain that they allow their fear to dominate them. And they begin to urge Jesus Christ to leave their region. 34, again, we are not told what it is that scared these people so much. I mean, I think the only thing we can conclude is it was the unknown and the fact that supernatural powers are at work in their vicinity and they know it. And that scares them. But they did not express even the slightest curiosity, nor did they ask him any questions. 35, some have suggested that these people thought the destruction of the pigs meant that Jesus Christ was there to harm them. Now, if that's what they thought, obviously that the logic flows from there pretty simply. Okay, Jesus came and killed our pigs, and it's his way of telling us, I hate you. Well, one could see where a person could draw that conclusion. Now, that's not the case, but that may, if you're dealing with superstitious people, you know, and most people, I think, are superstitious to some level. Doctrine helps, you know, get a lot of that out of you because you realize, well, God's in control of everything. So I need my rabbit's, I don't need my rabbit's foot. Or do I? It wasn't lucky for the rabbit. So much for superstitions. Three-legged rabbit hopping around out there. You know. Well, some have suggested that these people thought, you know, well, that he's there to hurt them too. And clearly they wouldn't have wanted any more of that. In 36, others have suggested that the news of Jesus Christ had reached this Gentile region. And they had accepted the Pharisees' view that Jesus himself was demon-possessed. And 37, to me, that seems unlikely since the official pronouncement, and that should have been from the delegation at Jerusalem, had not been made until the previous day. I mean, we don't, certainly word had begun to filter out of Jerusalem about the official position on Jesus, but this was largely a Gentile region. Would they have cared what the religious leaders in Israel thought? Probably not. It seems to me, since they make that declaration just the day before, I don't think the news has had time to really penetrate this region about Jesus. And again, because it was maybe largely Gentile, they didn't probably care. What, there's a son of Jesus is traveling around doing stuff, who cares? Well, when he comes here and kills your pigs, you'll care. Well, of course, again, I'm being ludicrous because Jesus didn't kill the pigs, although people have blamed him for it. Well, 38, it seems more likely that these people recognized the great power of God that had been manifested in this event. And such a display left them unnerved in light of their own spiritual condition. That, to me, seems to kind of explain everything. Here you are with, in this case, largely negative unbelievers. And when you come into the presence of Jesus, and it's very difficult, again, for us to get the feel for this because we're used to being around certain people and we have certain circles in which we run and all that. And we may be comfortable with certain things, but if you introduce Jesus into the middle of it, to give you an example, it's like, okay, and this is why I don't tend to tell people, you know, so much that I'm a minister of the gospel. Because they start acting different and weird. They're like, you know, everybody's going along having fun. I mean, I've literally gone to, you know, different social events and not connected with a church, but and then somebody would say, well, what do you do? And I'd say, well, I pastor a church. And the atmosphere would change. Because, see, I'm such a holy Joe. And it's messing with them. Or so they think. They don't know me very well. But with Jesus, it's all very different. I mean, you come into his presence. First, you're in the presence of perfection. That's got to be a little freaky. And we saw that, you know, for instance, even at the beginning of the call of Peter, Peter freaked out when they had that large catch of fish. He falls down at Jesus' feet and said, depart from me. I'm a sinful man. You don't need anything to do with me. So well, this is a good object lesson, you know, when you think how sinful you are. And I ought to throw in the towel. I'm just a loser. I'm a wretch. Well, don't worry. Jesus is used to it. He's put up with Peter and other wretches and me. Well, so you come into the presence of Jesus, though, and your spiritual condition is such that you may not feel all that comfortable. And if he has any spiritual demands on you, well, that's even going to make you more nervous. What does he want? Well, 39, these people express the irony of negative volition. They are more comfortable with a demon-possessed man terrorizing their community than they are with the Son of God being in their presence. Well, what a trade-off they've made here. You know, you reject Jesus, but you're, you know, the guy being out there doing that, well, we could live with that. Well, that's kind of odd. That's weird. Well, 40, however, that is the nature of negative volition. They are more at ease with Satan than they are with the light and with the truth. 1 John 5:19. And this verse pretty much defines for us the cosmos. By the cosmos, I mean that orderly structure out there under Satan that is dominated by principles of force, fear, greed, lies, and all that. And their relationship with their father, the devil. Again, this whole nonsense, oh, we're all just brothers, oh, we're all sons of God, we're all just a big human family. No, we're not. Never have been, never will be. 1 John 5:19, we know that we are of God. We find our source in God. This is where we look. And that the whole world lies. The reverb there, chymai, means to lie, to recline, to lay back. As it were, Satan's their sugar daddy, and they're laying on his chest. That's them, in the lap, or in the power of the evil one. They recline in or on the evil one. And the physical picture, again, is, you know, somebody cuddling up, you know, a baby to its father or mother. Well, the cosmos cuddles up with Satan. So, and you can see why the world is never painted in a favorable picture in the Bible. It's not favorable out there. Well, 38, the agreement was unanimous according to Luke, who records the fact that this was the desire of all those that came out to meet Jesus. Luke 8:37, the synoptic parallel there. All the people and the surrounding district asked him to leave them. And, you know, what does Jesus do? Now, see, here's where, you know, the fundies might tell you, well, you need to stand up for the truth. No, Jesus gets in the boat and leaves. Well, and sometimes you have to know, I mean, this is the nature of being led by the Spirit. Sometimes the Spirit's going to lead you in directions that are opposite of what you may think. And you have to recognize that leading. And for Jesus, the deal isn't here to say, now you people need to reconsider. By the way, I'm here. I can save all of you. I can fix your land. I can do, you know. No, he just gets in the boat and goes. He just responds to what they desire. Essentially giving them what they want. Well, verse 18, as he was getting into the boat. Now, Luke alone records the fact that he got into the boat. Now that's at the end of verse 37 there. And he got into a boat and returned. Maybe a different boat, we're not told. I'd have to go look at Luke and see if there's a definite article there. There may not be. I don't know. So 18, as he was getting into the boat. And you've got a chi here that is not translated. Again, the New American Standard is fond of just skipping over this because it is redundant in a lot of these things. But that's just Mark's connective. And he just writes these, you know, and, immediately, and. That's just the way he writes. So not translated here. As he was getting into the boats, the present active participle of embino. And this means to go into, literally, embaino. Temporal participle, while or as, they've translated as here, which is fine. To step into an area. Generally, it means to step down into, and it has the idea, it's very much used, this is the verb for boarding a boat or a ship. And as he was getting into the boat, and this participle is a genitive, it's a part of a genitive absolute clause here, because, again, the genitive absolute clause just provides you attendant information without changing the structure of the sentence. It's sort of an add-on just to give you attendant circumstances. So as he was getting into the boat, that's not really the important thing here. The important thing is the main sentence. The man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him. So as he was getting into the boat, him is Jesus, third masculine singular of autos. Into the boat is preposition eis plus the word ploion, P-L-O-I-O-N, with a definite article. Again, the same boats that they had just traveled over there on. Again, my suspicion is this is the next day, but not probably late in the day by any stretch. I mean, I would think all this would have been happening pretty quick. He kept on. You've got an imperfect here, and they've translated it as an imperfect in the New American Standard. Was imploring, again, as parakaleo, to call alongside, to urge, to exhort, to encourage. can mean here, as it does here, implore. He kept on asking him. Him is Jesus, Altos again. The demonized man, aorist deponent participle, the one having been demonized. And here Mark switches now to the form, he's used the present tense again earlier because it was the people's perception. Now it's over with, and now we know that the man's no longer demonized. So Mark doesn't accommodate their view that he's demonized because he's not, and they know he's not now. So they, the one was imploring him that he might accompany him. The hina here, it's taken two ways, but his purpose clearly is expressed in this clause. But when followed by verbs of exhorting or asking, hina is usually used to introduce a discourse of what was stated or what was asked or what was exhorted. So, but his intent, clearly it's his purpose that he wants to go with Jesus. So in order that with him, he might be, literally. They've translated it as accompanying him. He wanted to be with Jesus from then on out. That's the force of this. He wasn't just wanting to go with him on this trip. He wanted to be a permanent disciple and follow Jesus right then. So this man has had an astonishing day. You get up, you know, you're killing some raw animals out there, eating them, you know. You're gashing yourself with stones. You're howling and screaming, running naked. And then Jesus shows up, casts all these demons out of you. Now you're in your right mind. Then you realize, wait a minute, this man is the Messiah. This is the Son of God, as it were. And I believe in him, and he saved me, and I see it. And now I want to be a disciple. Well, he didn't waste any time. I mean, he was gung-ho. But it wasn't part of God's directive will for this guy. And this is where sometimes as a believer and in, you know, Jesus, and if you're in positions of leadership, sometimes you just have to tell people, no, it's not God's will in this case. And you just have to trust that Jesus knows what he's doing. And, of course, he does. That's not hard to trust. So he asked him in order that with him he might be, literally. He know with the subjunctive of the to be verb, I mean that he might be with him, a preposition meta, with him, accompanying him. But the to be verb indicates that he wanted to be with him all the time, not just on this trip. But he did not let him. But he said to him, go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you. So God's directive will for this guy is to go back and be a witness in his community. But specifically first to his house, his household, his people, his kinsmen. Tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you. And is actually but here, as they've translated it, it's chi, and used in an adversative sense. But he did not allow him or permit him. Negative u plus the verb, aorist active indicative of aphiemi. A-P-H-I-E-M-I. And this means to allow something, to permit something. Him is the formerly demonized man. He did not let him. The he is Jesus. He's the subject of the verb. But, strong adversative conjunction here, Allah, he said to him. Or he says to him. Again, Mark tends to write in this historic present tense. He says, Jesus says, to him, the demonized guy. Go home. It is actually hupago, present active imperative. Again, the imperative is the mood of command. And under the principle of the royal imperatives, God doesn't have to say, would you, or pretty please, or anything else. It's just a command, straight command, do it. And so this is the nature of authority and the structure of the chain of command. And you recognize that the disciples, even as they got oriented to all of this, not right now, but later on, you see they use the imperatives frequently with their followers to tell them, do this, don't do that. Either the imperative or the negative with it, and to form a prohibition. Do this, don't do that. And don't debate about it. You know, the force of the imperative is do it. It is an appeal to the will to obedience. Hupago means to go away or to depart, literally. So they translated it, go home, depart to your house. A preposition, ice. Plus the word oikos, house or household. First, there's the physical structure, of course, and then there are those that live within the house. And we commonly call that the household. So go to your house, genitive of Sue, to the ones of you, literally. Preposition pros is to or toward, and then you've got the definite article, the accusative masculine plural, and then you've got this adjective sos, and that means of you, accusative masculine plural, your ones, literally, and it has the idea, of course, of family or kinsmen. So go home to your people. That's fine. That kind of conveys what's going on here. And report to them what great things the Lord has done for you. And is Kai, apangelo, again, another imperative, apangello. This means to report or announce, to proclaim, to give an account of. Tell them, report to them, dative of su, again, this would be, or pardon me, dative of autos, to them, the members of your household, your relatives. What kind of things? You've got this adjective here, hasas. And it can be used of number, as many as. It could be used of extent, as much as. It can be used of kind, what kind of. As great as, how many things, the types of things. The types of things, well, he's really only done one thing for him at this point, you would think. But he's also given him salvation. The man has believed at this point. So now his story isn't just, I was demon-possessed and Jesus delivered me. I've now accepted him as my Savior. My life has completely changed. And obviously, very much changed. And again, this kind of forms, as we saw in the beginning stages of this, I pointed out to you that this man is kind of a type of the world at large of all unbelievers. That they are held captive by forces of darkness beyond their control. And that there is no human deliverance from this. It's only divine. It's the only way they can be delivered. And that they live in darkness, and that's typically the state of all unbelievers, of course. So go home to your people and report to them what great things, or what kind of things, they translate here, what great things, the Lord has done. Hokurios, here Jesus applies the term Lord to himself, but is he applying it to himself, or is he attempting to push the man and focus him on God? Because Kurios would have been the address for God at that time. Now, he could have used theos. He could have said that what God has done for you. So either he's pointing to the man that I am the Lord, but the man, I think, has already accepted this. Or he's pointing, you know, give credit to God for all this, what God has done for you. So has done, the Lord, to you, dative of singular of su, has done, perfect, active, indicative of poieo. And it's a perfect tense in that the things Jesus has done for him have existing results. No longer will he be demon-possessed. Ever again. He has salvation, so he can't lose that. So the two things Jesus has done for him are, well, the two most significant things you could do for anyone. So what things the Lord has done, and how he had mercy on you, and is Kai, and how he had mercy. There is, they've supplied the word how here because it's not really in the text. You got this verb, eleo, E-L-E-E-O. That word means to be concerned about someone, to show pity, compassion, or mercy. And then on you, you've actually got the accusative of sue. That he is cat. I would expect the dative there to you or for you, but it's actually the accusative. He's the object of mercy. And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed. And again, while I think in the previous verse, Jesus is pointing him to God. Give the credit to God. He runs out and gives the credit to Jesus. Well, you can understand that. I mean, Jesus is the visible manifestation there, and he's the one who did this for him as far as he's concerned. Obviously, God allowed all of it, but he gives the credit to Jesus. So he went away, he departed then, and is Kai. Went away or depart is aperkomai, the verb to go away. And he began, again, our verb arko with a complementary infinitive to follow of keruso. This means to act as a herald, to proclaim, oftentimes it's translated preach, but again, to me, preaching has such a negative connotation at this point, because there are so many preachers out there. And they typically are not teaching verse by verse. They are not using the original languages. They are doing the 3 points, a poem and a prayer, the great sermonizing of the last days. And of course, it's our contention that that doesn't get the job done. And while it might be neat to hear an alliterative sermon, it doesn't advance believers in some ways, because it doesn't get them in contact with the word so much as it gets them into contact with this neat little layout you've got. So he begins to proclaim, to act as a herald in the Decapolis. Preposition and plus the definite article, and then that word Decapolis, of course, means the 10 cities. D-E-K-A-P-O-L-I-S. Again, the Greek word polis for city, and deca from 10. The 10 cities, again, the region mostly east of the Jordan, but it extended south and north from the Sea of Galilee. And then hasas is used again, this pronoun, as many as or as great as, and then the verb poieo is used again. What great things Jesus had done for him. For him or to him is the dative of advantage, obviously. To him, the demonized man. And then Jesus, now here you have the nominative masculine singular. He actually is the subject of this, but it's not his. That doesn't come in the Greek until now. And all of them marveled, and everyone was amazed, is the way they've translated. You got and is chi, a nominative masculine plural of pos, all of them. Everyone. And then the verb thaumazo. Again, this verb means thaumazo. This verb means to marvel at, to be astonished, or to be amazed. Well, I mean, this guy's got a story. And you know, everybody in his family knows about him, knows about his past. And so, you know, when a believer, as in this case, he becomes a believer, makes this kind of turnaround, there's no arguing with it. And as you see it, you have to say, wow, there's no other explanation other than Jesus cast these demons out of him and gave him salvation. This is the only way we can explain this. And, you know, and it'd probably be fascinating to talk to him in heaven. You know, what was it like after, you know? What was it like before? I mean, to what extent he'll remember any of that, we don't know. But we presume we're going to have our memories with us in heaven. I mean, obviously God modifies them in some way, because we wouldn't be sitting around being happy thinking people were in hell, or we'd be happy knowing that, well, God's will's done and that's the way it is. Okay, well, we're going to have to stop there because our time is up. So we will get through the exegesis of that, and we will get to the exposition of that on Tuesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.